Oh, hello, Politics of Sound friends. It's Callum McDonald here. How on earth are you? It's been a few months. By the way, thank you so much for having me a couple of months ago. I really, really valued your company. And if you valued mine even a little bit, then why not come on over and check out my brand new podcast? It's called McDonald. That's spelled M-A-C-D-O-N-A-L-D. We're basically looking to escape a little bit from the world in the company of some brilliant and inspirational people. This week, the founder of Rant Media, Ahmed Baba, joins us. Come and hear about his trip from adversity to growth on McDonald, the brand new podcast.
The Politics of Sound with Ian Carnegie.
I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees. Die on my feet than live on my knees. My knees. My knees.
Welcome back. It's March and you're listening to The Politics of Sound, where my visitor to the record shop this month is the actor, musician and, as of just over a year ago, political activist Lawrence Fox. Now, he's a man who's used to press coverage and headlines, but who was seemingly unprepared for the media storm he created following remarks on the BBC's Question Time. Since then, he's remained a hugely controversial figure, speaking out on a range of issues and spearheading the formation of his own political party, Reclaim. But what is driving all of this? What is he ultimately hoping to achieve? And as a musician whose songwriting has a particularly confessional quality, what albums have contributed to his life and thinking? All this and much more with my guest, Lawrence Fox, on this month's Politics of Sound. Lawrence Fox, welcome to the Politics of Sound. We're in lockdown, so I have to ask, how are you and where are you?
Well, I'm fine. Thank you very much for asking and thank you very much for having me on. I am fed up of the sort of one-sided debate around lockdown. I find that a bit annoying. So I'm in the process of trying to broaden that debate out. And I'm in my office in London because cabin fever was getting a bit much at home. So I've escaped to the office with my brand new little puppy that I bought for my kids to try and keep their mental health going well through the lockdown.
And of course, you're currently navigating the vagaries of setting up your own political party, the Reclaim Party. And I'm sensing that the nuts and bolts of this are a real challenge. Is that so?
My Lord, not only are they a real challenge, can you imagine someone who's never done anything but being driven around in a Mercedes and paid loads of money to vaguely pretend to be someone else? You know, this is setting up an entire organisation. So, yes, and we were slightly rumbled in terms of the timing anyway. We were going to wait to announce, but the newspapers were going to do an article saying that I was starting a political party with Nigel Farage, which was not true. So we got rumbled much earlier than I expected. I was not expecting really to say this was going on until about now, as all of the stuff that I wanted to do is now coming into fruition, particularly this month, actually. It will start to come out and people will either love or hate me even more than they do already.
And you've also had problems with the name of the party. Didn't someone else have it?
There's a Manchester charity called the Reclaim Project who are extremely upset, who I'd never heard of. But also there's a female domestic abuse charity that was formed in 1996, also called Reclaim. And they're, you know, it's pretty hard to own a word, isn't it? So yes, it's been tricky dealing with the vagaries of that. But I mean, fortunately, if you're slow and organised in the way that you do things, you know, it's funny, isn't it? Politics is really weird. You think you're trying to do something good and then a charity come after you and go, well, we really care about working class people and you don't. And you're like, well, do you know anything about what I care about? I don't understand you guys. So, but fortunately, there's a charities commission and there's an electoral commission, and the two, never the twain shall cross over. So we get a full answer tomorrow from the electoral commission, which would be Friday the 4th, is it, tomorrow?
5th.
Friday the 5th. And then, and if they go, sorry, no likey, then they'll find themselves in court on Monday.
Now, you're well known as an actor. You're also a serious musician. But how would you describe what else you are? Are you a politician? Are you a political activist? How would you describe yourself?
I think I'm just a concerned citizen. You know, in lots of ways, sorry. Excuse me. I've always thought what I think. It sort of develops, like everyone's thinking develops. But, I definitely went through a idealistic Marxist phase when I was about 13. But now I've always sort of felt and responded to and reacted to a certain set of values. And I just, it got to a point, certainly in show business, where all of it was being undermined in the name of identity politics and wokery. And I just, it drove me mad. So I was, I worked with a full-on, fully badged up lefty in Kevin Whateley for 10 years. And, you know, we used to disagree about lots of things. And my best friend is a socialist. So it's not like I don't hang out with people with different political views. But there seemed to be developing this really, very pernicious orthodoxy that you had to subscribe to a certain set of views, and it's all about diversity and massive hyper-racialization of everything. And it seems to me we suddenly decided as a society that we were going to stop being progressive and be regressive and start instituting a load of things that were bound to drag people apart. So that's when I thought I'd say something about it. And then I got the full both barrels from the establishment.
Well, indeed. And I want to come on to all of that. But before we do, I just want to take you back just a little bit. The Fox family is obviously synonymous with acting. Would you say there was always a strong element of debate, of discussion about current affairs within the family when you were growing up?
Oh, hugely, yeah. And still today. So, if you spoke to them, there's diametrically opposed positions in our family. You know, which is great, but we were always encouraged to voice those around the dinner table. You know, our family dinner table was you needed to be fairly tough to survive a lunch at our house. You know, when people came over to you invited people over to lunch, they were pretty surprised what Sunday lunches turned into, which just really robust debates about whatever were the key issues of the day. So hang on 1 second, there's some really noisy people. Oh, they're gone. So there was some very sort of, the family dinner table was quite a zone for chats. I'm sorry, I've lost my train of thought from those people going on outside.
We were just talking about how debate was carried on within your household and the sort of flavour of that. And was there a lot of respect there?
Huge amounts of respect. You know, we were taught that you have to respect other people's points of view, and therefore my mum did it on the sly. She just encouraged people to say what they felt. And I think a lot of people do. I don't think it's a unique example in certainly in England and other parts of the world for people to voice their view. But my mum would encourage us to say what we felt. And therefore, because people do, obviously, because everyone's an individual, they feel different things. Therefore, the side effect of the freedom of your speech to say what you feel is the respect of someone to listen to someone else who has a differing view. And to be able to leave that dinner table, however angry or upset you got, which people frequently do, certainly, you'd have huge rows over weapons of mass destruction and the Iraq war and stuff like that, huge rows. But we would leave as friends, and we're still an extremely close family today, even though we have massively different opinions on lots of things.
Was there ever any expectation, perhaps even just in your own mind, that you would ultimately follow in the family business and become an actor?
No, we were not encouraged to. And in fact, I was, my great career highlight pre-acting was working for 30 quid a day as a gardener's assistant, labourer. And I did that for a while. And it started as, he said, it's 30 quid a day. And I started working for him. And he said, we work when the sun's up. And I was like, great, it's winter. I didn't start work until 9 o'clock in the morning and I finished at 2:30 or 3. And then it became the summer.
And you were working for 12 hours and more.
It was still 30 quid a day.
Why did you like it so much? What was so attractive about that job?
They paid me some money. You know, my parents were never, you know, I mean, extremely generous, my mum and dad. You know, I'm not knocking them, but they weren't partial to handing out money to their children. That wasn't their thing. So I just did it for money. I basically lived a sort of probably for a couple of years, not a couple of years. When did I resign? Height of summer, summer solstice, probably.
21st of June, I'm off. Goodbye.
21st of June.
You should have gone and worked off in Shetland, you know, or somewhere like that. Then you could have worked 24 hours a day.
Exactly. Welcome to Iona. Your work starts now. I just needed the money. So I got the money and I get my 30 quid a day. And then at the end of the week, I'd go and splash it on the weekend and go mad. Like, I'm sure most people, that's what most people do, you know, when they're young.
Yeah, of course.
And it was great fun. But then at one breakfast when I was really, I love smoking. And I woke up one morning and my dad was getting really angry with me about smoking in the bathroom out the window. And he said, what are you going to do with your life? And I was like, well, I don't know. And he's like, have you ever thought about acting? You might be quite good at it. You're quite outgoing, gregarious sort of soul. So I was like, oh, fine, I'll try acting, whatever. And I applied to drama school and then I got right to the final process, like the final few people, and didn't get in. And then I was just livid. So basically my acting career was just revenge for them not letting me in on the first time. So I then went back the next year and I got in the next year. And then I was extremely fortunate and did well. So I was very grateful for that.
Were you singing? Were you playing lots of instruments? Was music a very important part of that growing up?
I didn't pick up a guitar until I was 21.
Because I had this vision of you of being someone who was really good at music very young. They knew that you were.
I had to teach myself it. Well, I got taught a few chords by a friend who is my best friend, Socialist Paul Lunatic. And he taught me a few chords, and so I learned a few chords. And then I very quickly got bored of playing other people's songs. So I started going, well, I'll write my own songs. And then I taught myself a bit of piano, you know, from a guitar and all of that sort of stuff. And now I'm sort of really annoyingly forgetting it. I know I'm forgetting it. It's really upsetting me because I'm going, I don't have any time to pick it up at the moment.
So well, I was going to ask you, how much time have you actually had in this very busy period for you to actually go to your music and to find maybe solace in that? Because music is an incredible solace.
I know. Well, it's actually one of my main worries in life at the moment is that what I'm doing now, one of the casualties of it is that, you know, to me, it's kind of therapy. I was diarising all of my thoughts and my feelings, and I don't know where I do that now. So I walked past my piano on the way up to, I've got a couple of pianos actually, and I walk past one on the way up to my bedroom every day and I look at it and I just look sort of a bit mournful. And sometimes I go in and I just play a few chords just to remember that I can.
Just reintroduce yourself to it. You're probably feeling a bit sheepish. Is it looking at you a bit accusatory fashion and saying, why won't you play me?
Well, I think also you've gone through this sort of level of attack that I've been under. You start to feel slightly valueless. So you think, well, I've got nothing to offer because most of, you know, obviously a lot of the interaction you have when you make a political statement of any kind is it's going to be polarizing, isn't it? You're going to, some people are going to like you and some people are going to dislike you. So you're automatically alienating half of the people, let's say, for want of a better breakdown. And so you feel a bit valueless. You think, oh, well, what I've got to say, maybe I shouldn't say, seeing as people spend most of their days on Twitter either vociferously agreeing with me or telling me that they would hope I'm dead and that my family will die as well, you know. So I suppose there's a mental health area that you have to get into to be creative. So I think what will happen is once I've shifted the world in the right direction, which I'm going to do, then I can go back to it.
I mean, there have been a number of well-publicised media personalities who have started their own political parties. They've been the figurehead for them, as you are for your own party. But I just wonder whether it's something that you will ultimately just establish and then step back from and go back to, I suppose, the day job. Do you think that might happen?
My friend Paul calls it the elegant dismount. He goes, you've always got to prepare for an elegant dismount. So I go, well, no, because I think it's grossly unfair that people in this world should be stopped from expressing an opinion. I mean, even horrible opinions, I think people... I mean, it's one of the dreadful byproducts of freedom of speech, but, you know, you cannot just silence people that you don't agree with. It's not an answer. So I won't step away until that is remedied. And it seems to me that we're in such a dangerous place. Maybe people aren't quite onto it yet, but I think we're in a very dangerous place culturally with the silencing of people and the cancelling of people and all of that. That I'm not, it's almost a duty that I go, you will not cancel me. I will not be cancelled. And every time you try and cancel me, I'm going to come back to you with truth and honesty. And my truth, not my, oh God, he said it, I've gone woke. Not my truth, the truth, you know. My view. So I think it's a kind of, weirdly, it feels much more like a duty than it does a job.
One tradition that you did follow was to attend a particular public school, and there have been many reports of various misdemeanours that may or may not have occurred at that time, leading to, I think, your expulsion from that school. Was this maybe just an early example of the fledgling Lawrence Fox kicking against regulation, regimentation? Do you think it was that?
Yeah, I've thought about that recently. I've thought about, I love Bruce Springsteen, and I was reading about his school life, and he was, you know, really had a problematic school life. Anyway, I think I don't know, I've been told what to do. So if you're raised in a family where people are going, who, you know, be yourself, and then you go into an environment like a public school where, you know, we're talking public schools 1990, not public schools 2020, which I imagine are totally different ball games. I didn't like older boys rubbing a mug down across metal stairways going, boy, 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 boy. And the last one who got there got given the job of doing whatever he wanted you to do. I used to tell them to go fuck themselves, which involved me losing four front teeth quite early on in my school career.
And that's pretty shocking. Was it really that violent?
Oh yeah, it was horrendous, Harrow, at the beginning. But it's changed. The Child Act came in 1991, and then it changed pretty quickly. But but imagine what it was like. I mean, I think you could speak to someone who went to Harrow when they were 1951 or 61. I'm sure it was even worse. But yeah, that system of fagging is what it was called. Was well and truly, and we had stuff called jerks, which was where you were, you know, forced to do humiliating things. They would have, they had inside the middle of every schoolhouse at Harrow is something called a yarder, which is like it's a central atrium within a house. And, you know, they would throw the young boys in there, and people would throw all sorts of stuff out the window onto those young kids. You know, it was pretty horrendous, actually. But Harry threatened to sue me when I mentioned this in an interview once. But now I'm just like, of course they did. They're the establishment.
How do you feel about that school now?
Fine. I had an amazing English teacher called Jeremy Lemon, who also taught my dad, would you believe? And he gave me an extreme and wonderful love of language. I met an amazing man called Martin Tyrrell, when I reapplied to drama school, he said, right, you've got to be serious and I'll teach you how to do this, but you've got to be serious. So and my matron, who is just the greatest woman living. So I don't feel bad about it. It's just how it was. And I was a real arsehole, to be fair. So, you know, half of the crap that you get when you're there. And also I became an arsehole as well. This is the worst part of it. Is, you know, if you get involved in a system like that, that kind of very enclosed system, it doesn't encourage decent behaviour. It's Lord of the Flies, isn't it? You know.
But Do you think that you became that way and that behaviour was as a direct result of the bullying, the culture, all those things? Do you think you would have been like that anyway?
I just think I'm very much an individualist. I think people exist to share their understanding of the world with each other. And I don't think structures and organisations like public schools in the 90s, rather than possibly 2020, were particularly built like that. And I imagine that, you know, other schools are the same. You see kids walking out of school nowadays. On my way into it, well, not anymore, because, you know, who needs school for children? But you'll see they'll wear their tie in a certain way, you know, tied really short. You know, and there's lots of things, lots of sort of group peer pressured activities that people subscribe to at school.
And it's just subtle rebellion, isn't it? I mean, the short tie's been around forever.
Yeah, you know, and I was just one of those people that was like, well, why in my first year do I have to have two buttons in my blazer? Or my bluer, as they called them at Harrow. Why do I have to have two buttons done up in my first year, but in my second year I'm allowed one button done up? And by the time I'm 15, I've got all of the civil rights to have my blazer open. It's like these are pointless, arbitrary rules invented by boys to try and control other boys. And I was like, fuck you.
Now, you successfully auditioned for Harrow. No, you didn't.
I auditioned for Harrow.
You didn't audition for Harrow. No. You auditioned for RADA, and you got in the second time that you tried to do that. When you got there, did you feel, this is an environment that I can flourish in, I'm comfortable, this is a place that I can do something?
Yeah, I loved it. It was amazing. I was so happy to be there. And also, you know, I'd felt like I'd succeeded in some way. You know, it was good. And I was around mostly like-minded people. And actually, again, you know, student life and people have different views. It was quite exciting. So I really enjoyed it. I didn't hold any great expectations. I didn't hold any great expectations for the fact that I would, you know, end up being, you know, playing a bus driver from Wigan or, being a John Osborne play. I had a fairly solid view that I would be cast as kind of posh dudes and various. And I was fairly comfortable with it because I just enjoyed acting.
Were you cast in that way? Did you find that you were almost typecast as someone who was a bit upper crust or whatever? How you were perceived to be anyway?
Not at drama school. At drama school, they'll cast you as anything because, you know, it's pretend acting, isn't it, at drama school? But the minute someone's paying money for you to do it, yeah. I think I've played more posh people than not. And then my last acting job, I finally ended up getting an acting job that where I could play someone from somewhere else who was totally different from me. And then I went and blew it all by telling people what my opinions were.
You went on, as we know, to have a very successful acting career, most prominently, of course, in the Moore spin-off, Lewis. Mm. You were also playing, you were writing, you were releasing albums. It sounds like an idyllic time in your life. Mm. Is that true?
Yeah, it was good. I was married. I lived in the countryside. I had a horse. I had a fishing rod. I had a guitar. I had a little computer that I could record songs into. I had a fireplace. You know, it was pretty chill. Yeah, it was nice. And, you know, you're working as an actor, you're probably I was never hugely driven to work all 12 months of the year. So I would go, Lewis paid me well, so I'd do 5.5, 6 months of Lewis, and then I'd spend the other 6 months riding horses round or fishing for pike in the Weirpool and writing songs and having a fire and going to the pub. Loved it. It was heaven.
I mean, it seems like you had it all. And as we've mentioned, yet everything changed back in January last year, where initially this was as a result of comments you made about the Sam Mendes film 1917, and then very soon after, it was your appearance on BBC's Question Time. Were you surprised and taken aback by the reaction that hit you immediately?
Yeah, I was really surprised because every time I've ever watched anything with anyone, this is the kind of thing that they say to the screen, you know? So I think probably there were two things happened. There was a national sigh of relief that someone had said it. And then there was the other half you know, who turned around and said, right, it's game over for this chap now. He's said it. There's no coming back. And, you know, I sort of, I had a little window where I could have apologized and gone, no, you know, I'm really not like this. And, you know, done a load of charity work and pretended to be very virtuous. And I thought, no, I'm not sorry. I do believe it. And you know what? I believe it even more today than I did then. So I'd much rather be true to myself than not.
There's a quote at that time, I think I read, that you said, I should have shut all the doors to everything and just hunkered down. Why didn't you?
Because this, that it goes 100% against what I stand for, which is freedom of speech and the lack of perceive of what, you know, is loosely called political correctness, but I call the new religion of wokeism and moral superiority. People are not superior over other people. We are equal. And I know it's, you know, I mean, initially, when people had the good sense to look beyond themselves, initially we were all equal and made unique under the eyes of God. But at the very least, we should all be equal in the eyes of each other, you know? And I'm not, and I could have hunkered down, but I chose not to hunker down because what's the point in being alive if you've got to live a lie?
But there was this huge dichotomy for you. You ended up, I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but you ended up on medication, I think. You became ill, is that correct?
No.
I think you did.
No, I didn't end up on medication then. I ended up on medication. I was on medication when I got divorced because I couldn't sleep. But no, I ended up on, I ended up just in shock, really. I was just in shock. I was really surprised. I'm very surprised to be called a racist. I thought that was weird. I mean, you could call me naive or sort of actor spouting crap who's totally fine. I don't mind any of that stuff, but I was really surprised by the allegation of racism. I found that really weird.
But this was an extraordinary crossroads in your life. You had to make this decision. On the one hand, I understand that you were getting not just bad comments, but you were getting death threats. Mm. You had to then decide, do I live with this? I mean, it was about not just about yourself, but I think there was really nasty stuff about the family. Mm. It was looking at your career. You had a successful career. You were prepared to say all of that, no matter what happens, I'm going forward with this. How did you come to that decision?
It's not a decision. It's just, it's very easy. You just go, that's what needs to happen. Do that. Like, I've never not followed my instincts, and it's done me pretty well so far. You know, with a couple of, you know, you don't win them all, do you? But it wasn't a decision. I just thought, well, this is really not a good world if people aren't allowed to express themselves. That's a really bad thing. And it's not like I was saying anything controversial. I was calling someone out for being a racist, you know? And I was going, no, please stop being racist. And people don't like that because obviously in the sort of modern woke structures, you know, the only people that can't be racist, the only people you can be who, you know, white people cannot suffer racism. You know, so it's just not possible in the new world. And I'm like, if someone is trying to tell you that you cannot have an opinion based on your white privilege or perceived white privilege, then I'm sorry, that's racism. If you flick it round the other way, and you go, your black privilege allows you this. That's racism in my view. So I would say that once you start putting skin color or identitarianism into anything, you're in the language of division and racism. And I stand, I take a principled and very firm stance against any form of racism. So that hence why I was, I think probably why I was so surprised that was called a racist. Yeah.
What would you describe as at the centre of all of this? What are you trying to achieve ultimately?
What I'm trying to achieve ultimately is the right to freedom for expression for all, so that we as a culture, the culture continues as a conversation. The culture isn't, we haven't reached the apotheosis of culture in this way that the modern woke, politically correct, moral supremacist crowd think we have, where we can sit there and lecture everyone else about how they should behave and how they should do this and how they should do that, and ignoring biology and various things. My aim is to go, be free to speak. Don't say horrible, useless and terrible things, but be free to express yourself and stand against those that wish to silence you, because that is authoritarianism, and authoritarianism leads to mass murder. That's what happens. Every time it's been tried, it ends in murder. It's that serious. It's not a joke. You know, we carry on down this path of stopping people expressing an alternate view. Nothing good happens. There was someone, I was listening to Carl Hennigan, I think it was, on the radio the other day. You know, this guy is the professor of evidence-based medicine at Oxford University, right? That's his job. And if he doesn't have a view, and Oxford University, these are the people that created our vaccine, right, that gets us out of COVID. You know, he's not allowed a view because it doesn't subscribe to the orthodox view. Then we're in trouble. And he pointed out very wisely, I thought, that it was the fear that some other experts, many experts in his field feel the same thing, but it was the fear of expressing it and what would happen to their careers or their livelihoods, especially their lack of freedom of speech that was being imposed on societies, costing lives just in that debate, you know? So that's what I am. I'm someone who is an ardent believer and campaigner for freedom of speech and equality under the law for all, you know, and I'm very anti-political correctness, and I'm extremely anti-identity politics. I think they're divisive, poisonous things that have invaded our culture, and they need to be, I'll do whatever I can do to remove them.
You mentioned fear. Have you experienced fear in the last 12 months?
When someone said they wanted to unload a shotgun into my children's faces, yeah, I did. I was pretty frightened.
Was that from a social media platform?
I can't remember. It was passed on to me. Someone passed it through to me. So, yeah, it was...
Well, you've got into some quite nasty rows on Twitter with various people.
Yeah.
Is it a case of can't live with it, can't live without it? Why don't you just shut your Twitter account down?
Yeah, I think there's a case for that, actually. I think Twitter's a sewer. But, you know, what's that?
What do you gain by being on it? I mean, making another stand to say, don't think this is respectful debate.
Yeah.
I've had too many instances of this not working. I refuse to be part of it anymore. I will pursue my message in another way.
Friends closer, enemies closer. You know? That's what you gotta do.
So it sounds like you're staying with it for the moment, do you think?
Yeah, you know, and look, some Jesus wannabe with a beard just banned the elected president of the United States from the social media platform, you know? That dude was elected, whether you liked him or not. And, you know, little Jesus Jack Dorsey's decided, no, we can't have him on. And it's like, whoa. So I'll stay until they ban me, which they will, no doubt, at some point for pointing out something stupid like people with penises aren't women.
If you were Prime Minister under a Lawrence Fox administration, would you ban social media? Would you regulate it? Can it be regulated?
No, I'd regulate it. I'd give it a digital border. So I'd say that if the speech is not illegal or it doesn't break a law within the country that you're in, then someone in Silicon Valley has no right to deboost that tweet or mess with that tweet or have the algorithm do anything other than that. If it's not illegal in England and you say it and Twitter decides to, you know, either block you or suspend your account or whatever they do, I've never had my account suspended, then it's fine. It's not illegal. So why does the technocracy get to decide what people can say? And I know it comes from a compassionate place, so I completely understand that that's what they're doing. They're trying to make a more inclusive area, so they invent these things called community guidelines and stuff like that. But one of the problems with their community guidelines is some of those community guidelines don't make any sense. So, you know, like learn to code went mad. You know, you're just re-saying what Hillary Clinton said to a bunch of coal miners in the middle of Appalachia. And it's like, and then someone goes, learn to code. And then suddenly all these accounts are getting canceled because you've offended some blue-haired twat in the middle of Silicon Valley. I'm sorry, that's not how democracy works. The people elect the leaders and the leaders make the policy. That's how I think democracy works. Not the people elect the leaders and then the leaders. And then, you know, Jack Dorsey decides what is and isn't appropriate to say in humanity. That's how I believe. I just think that makes common sense to me. Otherwise, what's the point in being in a democracy?
Well, we're going to have a slight change of tone right now because it's time for you to go into the Politics of Sound record shop. You're going to get to pick three of your all-time favourite albums and we're going to hear all about them. Are you ready to go into the Politics of Sound record shop, Lawrence Fox?
I'm ready.
So, Lawrence, how was your visit to the Politics of Sound record shop? Going into a record shop, is that a good thing for you?
It used to be when they were open, yeah. I miss record shops.
Can you put that into your manifesto? We must bring these things back.
Yeah, I like hard copies of things, don't you? The idea that, you know, that there's a digital copy of something. You know, I like every other sort of London liberal owner, you know, one of these sort of retro-looking record players. And my brother-in-law buys me records frequently. And I actually start the day with my kids with the record player on with Three Little Birds or Two Little Birds. Is it Three Little Birds or Two Little Birds, the Bob Marley?
Yeah, series. Three Little Birds by Bob Marley.
And it's a great mix, something.
Well, your first album choice is possibly the most personal we've ever had on the Politics of Sound. It's a 2019 release. What's the album?
Well, I thought I could up my own record sales by buying my own album. So I went in and bought my own album, which is, well, one of my own albums. I've done two and an EP. But and I chose it because actually the song, there's a song on it called The Distance, which was the song that got me into all the trouble in the first place. So I was on, went up to Manchester, where is BBC based nowadays? Leeds or something like that.
It's I in went Manchester, Salford.
Manchester and Salford, that's right. So I went up there to be on Nihil's Radio 5 show and play a couple of songs, one of which was The Distance, which is a sort of anti-woke song, actually. And I got into a bit of an argument with him on that while I was there. And then my PR man said, do you want to do Question Time? And I was like, yeah, I do. God, how fun would it be to say what I actually thought to the
Had they seen you on that show and thought this guy could?
No, I think they'd booked me in before as part of the promotional tour because it was obviously it was a political song. So I then went on, and yeah, that. So I listened to that song with great joy, and I go, ha! It's true. So I bought that song. I bought that album. Yeah, and I've increased my record sales now. I'll probably make over £300 this month. You never know. Keep your fingers crossed.
As you said, it's your second album, the first being Holding Patterns from 2016. Yeah. What is it within A Grief Observed, apart from that track, that makes it so special for you? Do you feel it's more of a personal album than your debut?
Well, it's all personal. I don't ever write anything that isn't personal. And personal, and then it becomes a bit advisory, which is, you know, that's what know-it-alls are like, aren't they? So I was given, when I got divorced, I was given a collection of C.S. Lewis's books. One of them is called A Grief Observed. And there was this amazing bit in the book where he's trying to describe losing his wife and how much he loved her.
And this, of course, was originally detailed in the play and then subsequently the film Shadowlands.
Yeah, it's stunning. And he said he said that he became resentful of memories that he didn't even share with her. So he was angry with her for dying, and so much so that she'd tainted his childhood before he'd even met her. And I just thought that was such a wonderful idea of what the idea of grief and losing something is. So I thought, you know, I'm going through this very traumatic experience, I'm going to document it. So I documented it. And I find it very painful to listen to, actually. Very painful to listen to.
It's a very different listen to that original album that you made 3 years before. And there's maybe a hint of, say, Leonard Cohen in the way that you deliver the songs, and also of a sort of baritone Chris Martin of Coldplay. Many people have said that. Do you think that might be true?
Well, I mean, it's both great compliments, so I would be very happy with either. I mean, Leonard Cohen was an amazing lyricist, wasn't he? You know, and he managed to make hugely epic songs out of tiny amounts of musicality, you know.
Like a bird on the wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free.
So there's a very anthemic quality to Leonard Cohen's work. I love that. And I suppose just because I smoke like a trooper and, you know, I haven't really been musically trained, I try and I've over the years tried to learn to sing within my range, which isn't that big.
And do you think that smoking has affected your singing?
Yeah. I mean, I sound, someone described me the other day like a voice that had been dragged up a mine shaft. And I thought that's quite a good description.
They have put something in the water. They seek a cure for the conversation. They stole a march on your indecision. And the first to fall was laughter, just to quell the unoffended. They seek to murder your opinion. And the light has been turned out on the age of reason, replaced by blinding fires that burn wild across the region. For the wrong to rule, the good must just stand idly by. So I need you more than ever. I need your hand in this resistance. If we're going to go the distance. And if I'd want to leave, then. And the world outside is wondrous why, for a reason. If you can't decide, you must blow your own mind. For that reason, for the wrong to rule, the good must just stand idly by. And that's no lie. So I need you more than ever. I need your hand in this resistance. If we're going to go the distance. If I ever doubt it, I think about my future. And if I want to leave.
Lawrence Fox with a track from his album, A Grief Observed, that was The Distance. So, Lawrence, your second album is a 1984 release on Columbia Records. What's the album?
Born in the USA, Bruce Springsteen.
But it's an interesting choice. It's a release that's sandwiched between two very personal, introspective albums, almost like yours, Nebraska and Tunnel of Love. I thought you might be drawn to one of those rather than the more radio and arena friendly Born in the USA. Do you think that's a fair
Tunnel point? Of Love's got my favourite ever Bruce Springsteen song on it, I think, which is Brilliant Disguise on Tunnel of Love. I think it is.
It is indeed, yeah.
Yeah, so that's my favourite ever Bruce Springsteen song.
Tell me what I see.
No, I think it was so important because it was the first one I listened to, I would say, and it was my introduction to him and my dad, who was a huge music fan.
But you would have been really young at this point, probably about six.
Yeah, but you've got to bear in mind that my father was an actor and he used to vanish for many months at a time to go to far-flung corners of the world. And we're talking about the early 80s when you picked up a hotel phone in a Indian hotel somewhere if you're filming and you try and call your family and it's, you know, your entire film salary is going on one phone call. So he would vanish for many months at a time. So there was always this little ritual before he went where him and my mum would usually have a little jiggle around to Leaving on a Jet Plane or something like that. But Bruce Springsteen. And then dad took me, one of my first concerts I think I ever went to was dad took me to watch a Springsteen concert. I was just astonished and blown away by how amazing he was and how much the E Street Band were, of which I sat opposite Steve Van Zandt back in the day.
Where was this concert? Was this at Wembley Stadium or somewhere?
Yeah, it would have been. No, it was inside, so it might have been the arena. I don't know where it was. I can't remember. I was young, though. And no, I love Springsteen. I actually, you know, I have a secret heart. I couldn't work out which album. There's loads of them. I really like The Rising, actually. I think it's an amazing album too. And The Ghost of Old Tom Joad. I love those things as well.
And The Rising came out as his reaction to the
9/11. Yeah, Into the Fire. That song, Into the Fire, it's hauntingly brilliant.
May your strength give us strength. May your faith give us faith. May your
What a great songwriter. What I love about Bruce Springsteen is the fact that I imagine him and I wouldn't agree on anything. I really do. I think we probably wouldn't agree on anything except God. That's what I think.
I was going to ask you if you met him. It was one of my questions. If you met him, how do you think you would get on? At least, would you have a political debate with him? I know you would, but
yeah, no,
would totally you find would. Anything to agree on?
Yeah, I think we should all try and find things to agree on as much as possible, or try and learn from somebody else. And, you know, he's obviously had a totally different life to mine. He grew up in Jersey and he was, you know, he you know, certainly the reaction to that, certainly to the title track was, you know, still, as we talked about, is misunderstood today. But as a lyricist and as a message giver and as a message sender, he's unparalleled. You know, it just also the scansion of the of certainly my hometown and stuff like that. The way that he gets such banal facts into this most wonderful bit of storytelling, and it's heartbreakingly good. So the gift of a true artist is to put you in a place, an exact place with them at that time, and that's the skill that he has. And besides that, he happens to have one of the greatest bands working alongside him. And yeah, I just think he's absolutely awesome. But you can tell from the way he writes that he feels very responsible to a message or to something that he's trying to say. And it's his deep compassion. What did he say? He did say this. He said that, what was it? He said that God can save but shouldn't judge, or something like that. So I think he's got a complicated relationship with, I can't remember exactly what he said, but I think he's probably got a complicated relationship with his own faith. And, you know, Glory Days, all of these, was Glory Days on that album? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And Dancing in the Dark, obviously, wow, tune. I mean, who wouldn't know that tune?
Is there an arena-friendly big studio rock album in Lawrence Fox, do you think?
Well, I'm not very good at singing, which is one of my problems.
I think a lot of people might disagree with that if they'd heard your albums.
Well, yeah, you know, come and see me live. You know, I don't think I'm that brilliant at singing live. I'm very, very nervous because I've got nothing to hide behind. So I can't hide behind my character and say, well, my character's like that. You're basically being very honest about stuff, and I find it very exposing. So I don't really mind recording it and then other people listening to it. I find it very painful, actually, to say it, to sing it out loud.
So you don't adopt some other sort of persona when you're on stage as a musician?
I should have done. You see, that's the thing. When I first started doing music, I should have called myself something like Rainbow Unicorn or something, and then I would then I could have hidden behind the persona of what Rainbow Unicorn stood for musically, but unfortunately I stupidly went for my own name like an idiot.
Well, Bruce Springsteen was one of a galaxy of stars who played for the Biden inauguration.
Yeah.
Why do you think it is that musicians tend to support more left-leaning politicians than they do right? For instance, if you look back 4 years at who played for Donald Trump, the artists on show there are possibly less well known.
I love that. I got by the end, because Trump being one of my favourite stand-up comics of all time, his rallies, he had this song, it was amazing. And it was such a terrible song. But by the end of listening to it, because I used to watch your rallies, and he'd go, China, excellent. And all of his sort of crazy crap that he would go on about in his rallies. It was that, I long to be an American. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. At least, yeah, it's hilarious. It became a bit of an earworm by the end of it. I think mainly, look, if you're an artist, you'll probably, you lean towards gratitude. So especially if you're a successful one, you lean towards gratitude and you go, you know, I want to raise up the voices of the unheard. So I could totally see why I can see why he supported Obama. I can't really see why he supported Hillary Clinton. And I can't really see why he supported Joe Biden. Seeing as I'm not really sure that Joe Biden's actually running America. But, you know, once a Democrat, always a Democrat. Probably once a Republican, always a Republican. I don't know. Donald Trump was... he's sort of an aberration, isn't he, in a way? But the argument does need to be had between, 14 executive orders about this and that and talking about... biological men being able to destroy women's sports. It's like, you know, I happen to be on the side of science on that one. Like, I wouldn't want a daughter of mine playing rugby with someone who was a bloke with long hair. It's just my view.
And therein lies, I think, another debate. But as you know, on this podcast, we have our own in-house band, the Politics of Sound house band, and I'm going to join them now. We're going to play the title track from that album choice of yours, and it's Born in the USA.
Listening to the Politics of Sound podcast, why not check out Debated and listen to some exciting, interesting and engaging interviews with political figures from around the world. With over 100 episodes available, there's no better time to start listening. Available on Spotify, Podbean, iTunes and many more. Check us out now.
The Politics of Sound.
Lawrence Fox, it's time for you to reveal your last album choice. What's the album?
My last choice is Jeff Buckley, Grace.
1994 release on the Columbia label. How did you come to know this record?
When I did my first ever acting job, I played music to make myself calm. It was a very emotional job. It was called The Hole. And it involved a lot of crying.
It's a horror film, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think.
It involved a lot of crying, getting upset and screaming, going, let me out of here, obviously, because it's a horror film. And I would always have my guitar on set. And the director decided, he thought, oh, maybe you should sing a song in the film. And he said, what song do you want to sing? And I'd been messing around with Lover, You Should Have Come Over. And then we had an argument about whether I should sing Lover, You Should Have Come Over from this album or Every Breath You Take from U2. And they wanted me to sing Every Breath You Take when my girlfriend in the film, Keira Knightley, what happened to her? Is she still working? And sorry, not Every Breath You Take. What's the U2 one? With or Without You?
From the Joshua Tree.
Yeah, that's it. Sorry, yeah. And I said, well, I'll do Love You Should Have Come Over. And he goes, but it's totally irrelevant to the film because she's dead. So, you know, you should go with or without you. And I didn't do it. Anyway, so we then, between the cast, got talking about the album and it started getting played a lot. And yeah, it's just stayed with me. And it's in total contrast to the Springsteen because, you know, he's very abstract in his lyric writing. You know, I can't remember what it is. Another, you should have come over looking out the door. I see the rain fall upon the funeral mourners.
Looking out the door, I see the rain fall upon the funeral mourners. Parading in a wake of sad relations as their shoes fill up with water.
The story of his relationship with his father, singer-songwriter Tim Buckley, is in some ways a heartbreaking one. I think he saw him twice, yet their voices sound very similar.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Nature and nurture. Fascinating.
I'm just wondering, in your case, in your love of this album, I mean, this is an artist stepping out of the shadow cast by a famous father.
Yeah. Quite successfully as well, isn't it? You know, it's... whether that affects my love of it. No, because I didn't even know who Tim Buckley was until probably a year after I listened to this album. I didn't even know that Tim Buckley existed. So,
but isn't it also what you've done, stepping out of the shadow of a famous father?
Well, I don't know. My dad actually, roughly this time, actually a bit 10 years earlier, my dad gave up acting entirely and went off to become a missionary. So I think he was 29 when he saw the what was going on with, you know, how show business careers end up. And he went off to do something meaningful. And I suppose there is an echo of that in what I'm doing. Mine, I feel, is a bit more accidental. Like, I don't feel I went, right, it's time to be a politician. It was like, it was more like, right, oh my God, my acting career's over. What am I going to do? So I thought, well, I'll make sure that no one else's career's ended as a result of having a perfectly rational, sane opinion about something.
Is there a particular track that resonates with you, either lyrically or musically?
I think it's Lover, You Should Have Come Over is the one. I love Lilac Wine. I love Last Goodbye. I love Grace. I mean,
and of course, harmonically, the album is so complex and rich.
Isn't it just? And I bet you there's no auto-tune going on there.
Well, I think we can safely say that. Amazing vocal performances.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to join the Politics of Sound band now for the last time, and we're going to play one of the most extraordinary tracks off the album, and that's Corpus Christi Carol.
Thank you.
The Politics of Sound Band there with Corpus Christi Carol, originally written by Benjamin Britten and featured on Jeff Buckley's Grace, the choice of my guest, Lawrence Fox. Lawrence Fox, if you could be granted one thing, what would give you peace of mind?
If I could be granted one thing, what would give me peace of mind? My children to be free and happy and know that they're loved.
And how does that manifest itself, do you think?
By loving them.
And yeah. Their wider environment, do you obviously has a part to play?
I'm one of those really unfortunate people that loves their own kids more than other people's kids. I just would love them to be everything they ever want to be, and that would make me happy.
Lawrence Fox, thanks so much for being my guest on The Politics of Sound. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Thank you, I really have.
The Politics of Sound.
You've been listening to The Politics of Sound for March. My guest this month was Lawrence Fox, and I'd like to thank him and all within his office for their assistance, and in particular, Stephanie Kowalski. As ever, joining me in the band this month was the guitarist Jeff Sprackling, and don't forget that you can keep up with all of the latest Politics of Sound news by following us on Twitter, that's at @politics_sound, and we are also a featured podcast on the Global Player, where you can hear each and every episode. We'll be back on the 1st of April, when my guest will be the journalist, campaigner, and prominent face within the independent left-wing media organisation Navarra Media, that's Dahlia Gabriel. Have a great month, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Politics of Sound.